Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, May 4th. History was made on Maui at the first ever Hawaii High School Surfing Championships. We hear more about this momentous occasion and look ahead. Could it be a model for other states? A North Shore resident shares how her garage became a pop-up donation hub for flood victims from the recent storms. And we learn about the dangers of mold as flood recovery moves along. The clock is ticking to stop the spread of spores. We hear from an Oahu native and local TikTok personality who released her debut novel while managing internet trolls. And we spotlight a community-led effort to manage our marine resources. It's coming soon to the island of Hawaii. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, we lead off with a historic story, the first high school surfing state championship in Hawaii. It took place this weekend, and Honolulu Star Advertiser sports journalist and columnist David Reardon was there. He called it probably the most important story he has covered in his more than 40-year career. We're here to talk about surfing because something monumental happened this weekend, and you got to be there on Maui to watch it all happen.
It was chicken skin, and I'm not even a surfer. I'm a hydrophobic Hawaiian. I am part Native Hawaiian, so it does mean something to me, but I almost drowned when I was like 8 years old, so I can go in the water. I can dog paddle, and I can take kids into the lagoon and let them play, help them play in the water. But I don't have the guts to get out on those waves like those kids do. I think it's great.
Yeah, I'm not a surfer either, but I'm a water person. The fact that it has taken this long to put surfing on the map here in Hawaii is crazy.
I think it has to do with negative stereotypes and making it easier for people who had other reasons to not want to do it. Whether those are political or would take a lot of, you know, some effort to do things to get it done and cooperate maybe with some people that you're not always used to cooperating with. That might be the nicest way to put it, I guess. Because, like, you know, it's huge. And there's a history in Hawaii high school sports where it took so long to get a football state championship and classification because it's very factionalized. So then the word I kept thinking about was lokahi, right? Working together to make things pono, right? So it was ironic or coincidental or whatever the correct word would be that Don Botello, who was very instrumental in getting the leagues together for football championships and classification, he passed away at age 93 the week before the Hawaii State first surfing championship, because in some ways it's similar. It is quite analogous, I think, having to get people together who didn't really want to even talk to each other because of whatever things that happened in the past, but it took some special people to be the connectors or the reconnectors. Yeah.
Well, I imagine, though, you know, I mean, you had coverage of the kids that made history, you know, for being the champions, you know, with longboarding and bodyboarding and shortboarding and there were small schools, so it was lovely to see these folks elevated.
That was so great. That was, to me, one of the best parts of it. Now, Wailua is a small school, but we have to remember, they have kind of an advantage of being, like, Haleiwa Town is in their district, right? So you're going to get a lot of shredders over there. And same with Kahuku. Now, Kahuku is known for football and other sports, but same kind of deal. Geographically, they're perfectly located to have some really good young surfers in their school. And another thing about this, too, is that you had kids who were being homeschooled and stuff, which is fine. And this got them to be part of a team and socialize more at an age where I think it's important to socialize. Not too much, though. Got to study, too. but that interaction and that thing about being part of a team, a lot of people think of surfing as an individual or even selfish or territorial, right?
Oh, yes.
With the localism, right? Now, this change, this might be a start of a really big change in that, I think, I hope, or maybe I'm being too optimistic, but this transcends a lot of things, right?
Yeah, and I loved, you know, reading your article because there were a couple of students from the Hawaii Academy of Arts and Science, right? And it was great. It's like, yeah, they sent four people and two of them won, right?
Yeah, I have to admit that I did not even know. I'd never heard of that school until this week or last week.
And it's not like there are a heck of a lot of surfing spots on the Big Island.
Well,
too,
you
right?
know, at least what happened to their they're in Pahoa, and their best spot got covered by lava.
Yeah.
So they had to go somewhere else and kind of, you know, it wasn't their home break. And,
right, right. And, against
and
all odds,
work
right?
their way in there. I'm sure that people over there were, you know, if they knew, oh, yeah, well, yeah, it's not your fault that the volcano erupted on
yeah.
your beach. So, but, you know, like you said, it can be territorial, right? But I think this brought a lot of people together, and I think it will continue to do so.
And today, you know, you have a column that talks about what's next. And it's important to have this conversation now because we've just proven it can be done, right?
Yes.
And I know that you had included a statement from the school superintendent,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I understand that he wasn't initially.
Yes. The,
he had to be convinced.
The DOE and one thing that happened, I've been writing columns and stuff on this for 10 years and following it through the legislature and things. And one of the things that struck me was a couple of years ago when they said that, well, we did a survey of the principals and not enough of them were interested. I mean, I wrote something, well, why are you surveying the principals for interest? Shouldn't you be surveying the students for interest?
There you
because
go.
If we work for the public and as journalists, we work public service, right? It's not usually based on your interest, but what is in the best interest of the community, right? And if you're a principal of a school, your community is your students.
Well, you know, in your column today, you know, you do pose that question, what's next for the sport?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but like I said, I'm hydrophobic, but I can body surf because what is body surfing? I'm sure there are experts who can figure out a way to score it. One thing, though, is you don't have to have expensive
right.
equipment. So maybe that would be a way that some kids from underserved communities or families that are economically challenged could participate.
Yeah, still compete. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Anything else that you think would be important to underscore as we watch this sport grow?
Well, I'm not a big guy with shout outs, but I think there's quite a few deserved ones on this. The one name that keeps coming up again and again is a guy named Kim Ball. He's actually a former wrestling coach, and he is the guy who's been the head man on Maui running the tournaments for more than 10 years. And that's the thing, too. And that's one of the reasons why it seems to me so doable, because it was actually approved more than a decade ago. But Maui was the only interscholastic league that took up on. Now, other schools like Kamehameha Kapalama, probably being a prime example, they have like surf teams, but they're not officially affiliated. And they won national championships in something called an NSSA, National Scholastic Surf Association. But Maui was the only one doing it as a sanctioned sport. And there's a guy named David Kazama. He's an Iolani graduate, and his daughter Sunny went to Iolani, and she was on the surf club team. And she was a big part of this, too, as her father was, because she testified before the legislature about how they were so, I'm going to use the surfer word, stoked about finally winning the first championship in their school history. And then they were instantly deflated because they found out there was going to be no recognition by the school because it's not technically a school sport. And so she made a very poignant speech to the legislature, state senate, I believe, and she interned with Senator Glenn Kwakai, who's been a strong proponent for this for many, many years. And there was an athletic director at least one who told me I was dead set against this, but she turned her around on it. And I think it was same was true with a lot of the elected officials who did kind of help. And then Carissa Moore, who a little more high profile, she, I think, and Keith Amamiya kind of helped convince the folks who were the decision makers that the surf business community would step up.
And they have. That was veteran journalist David Reardon, who covers sports for the Honolulu Star Advertiser, who credits a long list of people who helped to make surfing a sanctioned high school sport. Reardon also shared that more than a few surfers he's interviewed over the many decades believe the advice of following the turtles, the honu, out in the water has led to their success on the waves. You can find Reardon's coverage at staradvertiser.com.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
Hey, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. The extraordinary reach of New York Times journalism brings you the sound and the story. Times reporters unpack more of what you want to know about our nation and our world as it happens. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30 here on HPR One.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NereidHawaii.com.
We turn our attention now to recovery from last month's back-to-back storms that caused close to $1 billion in damage across the state. Joining us this morning is HPR's Cassie Ordonio, who highlights the efforts of a Wailua woman who saw a need and filled it. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and you spent time focusing on a community hub that this gal started.
I did. I actually spent about 2 weeks ago at this one woman's hub in Wailua off Kukea Circle, and her name is Charmaine Ariel, and she was one of the flood victims who had to evacuate her home with her family. They all had to squeeze into a car. It was her, her mother, her daughter, grandchild, and three dogs all in a small Toyota Corolla.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, she was really inspired by the community-led efforts that she was seeing throughout the North Shore neighborhood. So she and her mom, whose name is also Charmaine, started this hub just out of like the supplies that they had. And so, you know, it just started with, you know, some cleaning supplies, toiletries, and cases of bottled water.
It kind of just like happened. No hesitation. Me and my mom was just like, yep, let's set this table up and we'll put supplies that we got from the shelter when we were staying there. And then as people drove past, they're like, hey, can we drop it off over here? And we're like, yeah, sure, bring it on. And that's kind of how it started. So it's basically people helping people.
Yeah, and so now that hub has expanded. This is all out of her garage. Mm-hmm. So now she has 4 to 5 tables. You see like canned goods in the front, some clothes, more cleaning supplies, feminine hygiene products, you name it, she's got it. But this is kind of something that she's volunteering all of her time out of. And, you know, she was one of the many residents who did experience the floods. But her hub is one of the few that's actually operating 24/7. She answers phone at all kinds of hours, even like for me, if I have quick questions at 5 a.m, she's already like calling me just to explain to me, like, you know, just to answer my questions of what she's doing. Part of her efforts actually expanded to Molokai.
It was kind of like a coconut wireless kind of deal. One auntie told family members that they have on Molokai, and then they contacted me just by word of mouth kind of deal. I'm all over the map, apparently, me and my mom. I got donations from New York, Hilo, San Diego, mainland, a lot of mainland folks has reached out to me to donate. A lot of big companies, they always ask me if I'm a profit donation place, and I'm like, no, I'm a non-profit donation place. It just happened, and me and my mom was just like, okay, we're gonna do this. And then after a while, I was like, uh-oh, I found my new addiction, you know? I'd rather help people than do anything else. And just, it keeps me and mom busy and not think about what we have to fix up at the moment.
Charmaine's hub, huh?
Yep, exactly. Her whole house, it's like a multi-unit dwelling house where she and her mom stay in separate units. And then she also has tenants that she runs out to. Those tenants got completely wiped out. The flood was actually like to where one of her tenants woke up floating on his air on his mattress. But looking at the hub now, how much has expanded, the fact that it reached to Molokai, I just reached out to her this morning. She's waiting for all of those supplies to be picked up by today and to be sent out by a small cargo plane by this Friday. So all of those donations include hazmat suits, more cleaning supplies to get rid of mold, because that's what they've been experiencing over there, and mostly baby formulas and like some futons for them to sleep in for those who lost their homes as well. So she's still getting up there and continuing to donate. But she said she's more in need of like propane tanks, bug zappers, and even camping supplies.
We had charcoal. We only have one more bag of that. I'm trying to get more like push brooms and stuff like that, trash bags. We also collect futons and air mattresses and army cots, because a lot of people still can't stay in their house. And a lot of them don't really have family down here. And if they do have family, their family's house is way too packed to bring on more people to stay. So people are actually camping outside of their family's homes just so they have somewhere to stay. So I've been collecting a lot of camping stuff too, like army cots, pop-up tents, camping tents, you know, basically everything you would use to go camping with your ohana, right?
So what's next for her?
She basically said that she's going to keep continuing to help the community until there's no more donations. And she said that she's going to kind of take a break from working as a housekeeper at Turtle Bay, just because she's more focused on community efforts, on recovery, but also to fix up her own home. But spending time with her, she was more focused on getting the donations out there than fixing the drywalls in her house.
Yeah, because the need is great and she just wants to help fill it. It's incredible.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing from HBR's Cassie Ordonio. We can read her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency is fighting for its life.
I've never been a big fan of FEMA. It really doesn't get the job done, you know.
FEMA's a disaster.
FEMA's a dirty word.
People are waking up in droves to the FEMA camps.
How did the agency tasked with saving us become so distrusted and despised? Listen to American Emergency, The Movement to Kill FEMA, on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the NOAA Daniel K. Inouye Regional Center, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
A as we turn to cleaning up our islands following those recent storms. One issue that's emerged, as we heard, is what to do about mold. HBR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel has been covering recovery efforts on Maui and Molokai, and she joins us now. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so, yeah, mold, not so good when you've got water. It gets into everything.
Yeah, for sure. It just keeps on spreading. Red Lightning is a volunteer organization that's been working on Maui and Molokai since the Kona low storms in the early days, right after the flooding. They were helping, you know, shovel mud, and now they've been focusing on mold remediation. And they explained, you know, often people think it's not that bad. You know, they only got an inch of water in their homes, maybe, or their roof only had, you know, a couple small leaks. But you don't see the mold that grows behind your walls. And a lot of times people aren't aware of it until they start ripping out the drywall and it's just covering everything inside their wall. I visited the home of a kupuna on Molokai where Red Lightning volunteers were working hard, and I got to see firsthand what they've been kind of dealing with and how mold spreads. This kupuna had to throw out everything after the flood just engulfed her home. Her downstairs room was pretty severely damaged from flooding, and then also she had some roof leaks in that area and mold had started to spread. Here's Tyler Dahlgren. He is operations lead with Red Lightning, and he explained to me the process when they go in for mold remediation.
So we got all, you know, into our PPE and, you know, protective eyewear and masks and stuff, and then started bringing the drywall down, bagging it up. You know, the first step is to just get the affected material out, and then from there, then we'll come back after having it exposed. You can see that there's mold on the rafters. There was mold all over the drywall. So we'll come back in for the rafters and we'll spray to knock it down and kill it in its tracks, and then we have a HEPA vacuum that will come back through and try and vacuum up all the spores and bits of mold, and then we'll spray again and do that remediation to help stop it. Because the bad part about mold is that it's a living organism, so if you don't get ahead of it, if you don't kill it, it's just going to keep getting bigger and the problem's going to get bigger, and then you're losing whole structures, not just building material, you know. So time is really of the essence, and that's why we tried to get here ASAP. Same thing on Maui.
Yeah, it's a problem.
Absolutely. You can hear those Molokai roosters in the background as he was talking. But Red Lightning also helped right after the Lahaina fire. They've been around for a while. They were among the first to bring Starlinks into that area for the community after the fire. And they also assisted with smoke remediation. And, you know, Dahlgren said smoke and mold are, you know, certainly aren't the same thing, but a lot of the techniques are kind of similar. And he says often families and neighbors have been helping each other after the flood. You know, it's beautiful to see that collaboration and really reaching out to your neighbors to help. But not everyone has that support system, or they just don't want to ask. And so he says people are standing by, you know, volunteers wanting to help. Red Lightning has helped fill in those gaps, he says, so no one has to carry this burden on their own. The volunteers are local as well as coming from all over the country to help. And the group has helped nearly 100 households on Maui and Molokai with storm damage and flood recovery. They've also been joined by international support. And so working alongside Red Lightning volunteers were volunteers from Task Force Kiwi, which is a group from New Zealand, also volunteers, who have been helping a lot with the physical labor side as well as the mental health support after these disasters. And they're trained and ready to activate across New Zealand, but they've helped in disasters across the Pacific. Here's team leader Jenny Calder with Task Force Kiwi.
We do base our skill sets on the need. We go and we assess the need, so we'll assemble a team with the skills to go and help that recovery. So in New Zealand, we've responded to disasters following floods and storms, wind damage, going out and helping the community get back on their feet, helping that mental wellbeing space for the people impacted. So it's more than just hammers and tools. We also help veterans in need. We're all volunteers. It's a non-profit organisation, veteran-led. We've got about 800, or just over 800 volunteers on the Task Force Kiwi books. Yeah, it's a lot. And we recognise that people who volunteer, they also have jobs, family, things going on, but we just give the time we can.
So these folks from New Zealand, they actually, what, are here on island?
They're here. Yeah, they're on. They've been working on Maui and Molokai right alongside Red Lightning, and they've been doing two-week rotations here in Hawaii and, you know, just doing amazing work. Again, like she said, you know, a lot of the hands-on, the demo, the reconstruction, the spraying for mold remediation, but then also, you know, just talking to people and hearing the similarities, you know, of the cultures, it's been kind of a beautiful connection for them to have here. And so these two organizations, along with others, of course, so many organizations working in flood recovery since the Kona low storms, but they've really brought, you know, just a willingness and a skill set. You know, a lot of contractors are spread thin, and so these volunteers have been able to come in and really do that sort of immediate work that's required to ensure that the mold doesn't spread, you know, and then if there's more, you know, skilled labor involved later on, of course, contractors can come in and help families with that as well. But just getting in there and, you know, knocking the issue down, as he says, has been really critical. And so Red Lightning is still working on Maui and Molokai. And many of the volunteers actually have been traveling back and forth between the two islands, working in both places, and they'll be wrapping up their mission pretty soon. You know, still a lot of need. He said they've been doing everything from, you know, cutting trees and fixing culverts and doing a whole bunch of different things along with mold and working on the homes.
Well, we're so grateful that they're so generous with their time and their expertise. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you so much.
We've been hearing from HRA's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel. You can find her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses from art and film to history and gardening. Classes begin June 1st, olliuhm.org.
A new sci-fi novel features a young Hawaiian woman who must solve a murder to clear her name. The Killing Spell is the debut novel by Native Hawaiian author and local TikTok personality Shay Kawe. Kawe grew up on Hawaiian homestead land in Waimanalo. Her novel is set in the future, where magic is deeply attached to cultural languages. HPR's Russell Subiano sat down with Kawe to talk about her writing and the downsides of being a social media personality.
I read that your book, The Killing Spell, is the first traditionally published adult fantasy novel by a Native Hawaiian. That seems to be a huge deal. Congratulations on that. Can you talk about what that means?
I think it's just exciting to be able to write the kinds of stories that I always read, both as a kid, as a teen, as an adult, and to put a twist on them, to put people that I see in my own community, people who are a lot like me, who are like my papa and my nana and my family, all the extended uncles and aunts and those kinds of things, into a book, because I think it helps people feel seen in a way. I feel seen, you know, and like these big industries kind of going out of their way to find authors to do that. Kala Kendall, who wrote the new Twisted Tales by Disney for Moana, and I know at least in Kiala's case, like, they were specifically looking for a Hawaiian writer to write those stories, which is amazing. I'm glad that, you know, there's some attention and some desire and drive to push for our stories written by us. Yeah. Well, maybe historically that hasn't always been the case. So
So this is your first novel. Can you share a little bit about the story? Maybe just share a little bit with our listeners that kind of maybe just gives them an idea of what's really cool about your novel.
Yeah, I have like two pitch lines, I'll say. If somebody's local, I'm like, it's like if Homestead had magic. Because I grew up on Homestead, and that is entirely like, that was the original seed of thought for me. What if everyone in the Homestead had magic, and what would that look like? And then the other thing is, in a world where each language is its own branch of magic, what does Hawaiian look like in that world? Because I'm a language learner of Olalo Hawaii, relatively new to it, and it was kind of like top of mind when I was writing this as well.
Yeah, I only recently have I started hearing stories of kind of like magic within our Hawaiian culture. In your experience and things you've read or things you've heard from your kupuna, how much magic is there in our culture?
I think people in Hawaii and Native Hawaiians too kind of have this natural balance with magic existing side by side in the real world. It's very normal and natural here, but I think for other people, it might be a little bit weird if you're coming from the outside. Like, my grandma is very strictly Catholic, but does she believe in ghosts? Yes. Is she going to do anything to like piss off Pele when we go to Big Island? Absolutely not. Like, there is just this natural balance of both those worlds existing side by side. And I think I feel that too in a lot of ways. Although I personally don't have a lot of experiences with spiritual world, whatever you might want to call it, the magical world. Like, my great grandmother was somewhat in attuned to that. I actually live in her house now, but like, it was never something that was questioned. You just sort of respect what they say and do what they say if they tell you to do something. Yeah. So no specific stories about like night marchers or menehune or anything like that, but more just this general understanding that it is real and should be respected side by side modern day beliefs.
Here's one of the many things that I find interesting about your book, and really any story that includes magic. Spells don't always work the way the person casting the spell wants them to, right? In your book, you write, magic was finicky. It didn't like giving away things for free. Mm-hmm. And it must be so frustrating to be a wizard or a sorcerer or a spellsmith, like in your book. Why is magic like this? Why can't it just be more compliant?
I thought about that. I think of magic in my book as a skill. So much like language learning, because that's really like the basis for what it does. And it doesn't always do what you want when you want it. Everybody has a story of like trying to say something, it coming out wrong, mm-hmm. everyone laughing or making a bad situation worse. And I just wanted that to be reflected in my book. So it's like a fun fact. Anytime a spell goes wrong, it is something that personally frustrates me about that language that I get wrong a lot. I personally struggle with Hawaiian pronouns, which is, it should be easy. It's mm-hmm. like a very simple thing. And I, to this day, mess them up all the time. So that's why it's in there.
And your book is really an interesting weaving of ideas, right? It's clearly fantasy with magic as a very strong component. But there's also some like post-apocalyptic vibes, some very strong cultural and language underpinnings, and some clear socioeconomic themes as well.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about all the things that your book touches on, where did the idea for your book come from?
I don't think it's any one thing. Like, I think any book is sort of a mishmash of all these different influences that have impacted the author's life. I also think I, like many debut authors, am maybe guilty of making my main character a little bit too much like me and this world a little bit too much like my own. So it's very close to my heart in that way. But the trigger, the real trigger, I think, was, you know, I grew up in the Homestead. I thought it was small and boring and it didn't fit me and like what I liked. There weren't a lot of people who enjoyed the things that I enjoyed. I wanted to move out. And much to my parents' concern, I moved across the world for a man to Russia.
That's really far.
That's far. They were not thrilled with that. And I started learning Russian by necessity. And a couple years into it, I realized like I could speak Russian better than I could speak Hawaiian. And that was like a light bulb moment where I was like, what is the excuse that I have? I used to say I was bad at languages, like they were so hard, I could never do it. And I'd done it unintentionally, not perfectly, of course, but I didn't have shame when speaking Russian because it was like a survival thing. I just needed to do it. So it didn't matter if I was making mistakes. And I realized if I went home and I applied that same concept, I could probably make some decent progress in Hawaiian too.
What did you find was the biggest help for you in learning Russian that you could apply to learning Hawaiian? Did it have to do with immersion? Did it have to do with you know, having someone to constantly converse with?
I actually think it's the difference between them, because I do think it's immersion. So when I came back as an adult, incredibly difficult to find an immersive Hawaiian environment just because of the historical implications of Hawaiian. Like, short of moving to Niihau or a very small place in Molokai, where also you kind of have to be invited in, right? It's not cool to just show up and like insert yourself into people's lives. It was really, really challenging, and it still is challenging for me. And I think some of that unfairness around what history has done to the Hawaiian language to make it so inaccessible and difficult, even for those who are interested in learning, is something I wanted to showcase. It's all my own frustrations rolled into a book.
I can't let you go without asking you about TikTok. Mm-hmm. You have over 31,000 followers, which is pretty significant, I think. What does it mean to you as a storyteller to have an audience like that?
I don't know what to say about social media, because my original videos on TikTok, I was just honestly talking about the idea of the book, mm-hmm. and people were interested. But I really didn't start to gain followers until I started making my opinions about things like colonization, very well known, controversy picks up on social media platforms, and it's sort of grown that audience.
One thing I do appreciate is that when you do express an opinion, you support it with why you feel that way.
Oh, you did a deep dive on my page. I see.
Do you feel like, especially in this day and age, that a strong social media presence is a requirement for emerging authors? Do you think it's necessary?
Weirdly, no. I think it never hurts. It never hurts to have a social media presence. And I was always told, like, the best time to start growing your social media audience is long before you ever have a book deal, before anything happens. And I do think that's true to an extent. It's helped to sort of like build up momentum for my own stuff. But there are plenty of authors. I don't think it's for everyone. It requires a certain amount of thick skin that I think can be really damaging to certain authors if they're not mentally prepared to deal with that. Like, it's crazy to say, like, I've gotten death threats on TikTok and stuff, but that's true. And like, I'm okay with it. I can deal with it. But I know I wouldn't necessarily encourage if people are not comfortable with the depths of the internet and what it can be like to force themselves to do that if it doesn't sort of like align with them and what they want to do.
Those are all the questions that I had, but I don't want to end on that note.
I know. That's not a fun thing to talk about.
So what was it like for you on the day that you got your first copy?
So funny. I didn't get my first copy. I'll get them on Monday. I bought this at Barnes & Noble.
Oh, you got your own book?
Because it got shipped to the stores before it got shipped to me. I don't know if this is going to be a satisfying answer to this, but I think with every milestone, as exciting as it is, I just see what is ahead. Like, the goalposts keep moving. But for me, that's exciting because it's momentum to never really stop. Like, I am so excited for this book to be out in the world, for people to read it, and to hopefully be inspired to relearn their own mother tongue, whatever that might be. I think it applies beyond Olelo Hawaii as well. But I'm also excited for what I see on the horizon, like the next thing. I can talk about this. I can. Like, my next book is sort of secured with the publisher, and I'm looking forward to that. So I guess what I would say to people who are listening is to not stop and not get discouraged, because it doesn't really end. And that is a good thing. It is exciting to keep going forward in this industry.
Yeah. Love the process. Yeah.
Yes, process, yeah. It is. Like, that's the enjoyable part, the struggle.
Well, Shay Kawe, thanks so much for your time. I'm really excited to finish The Killing Spell. It's available everywhere, right?
Yep. Available everywhere.
Awesome. Awesome. Thanks so much for your time today. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, thank you, Russell. Thanks for having me.
That was author Shay Kawe talking with HBR's Russell Subiono. Kawe's debut novel, The Killing Spell, is published by Simon & Schuster. It's available in bookstores and online. Kawe will be at Hale Lehue, Ha Cafe in Lehue on May 8th, and at Basically Books in Hilo on May 9th. Head to our website for more details. We'll be right back. few years ago, the state launched a new approach to manage our aquatic resources. It started with a pilot on sustainable fishing, tapping a hui of about 20 members from the community to establish rules for harvesting. It was so successful, it's now expanding to the Big Island this month. It's called the Holomua Marine Initiative. Holomua means move forward in Hawaiian. The idea was driven by then-Governor David Ige that the state should strive to protect 30% of nearshore waters by 2030. Holomua uses state and federal money, as well as a fund managed by the Hawaii Community Foundation. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Miley Shannon, a member of the Maui community team, and Luna Kekoa, ecosystems manager for the State Division of Aquatic Resources. Shannon starts us off.
Our family has been nearshore water people for years and generationally, of course. But more importantly, recently after having children, in 2009, we opened our own conservation company to malama the kai resources anyway. And then we had the ability to develop that knowledge through the next couple of years. And for us, my children are lava'a. Their fathers are lava'a. Grandfather was a lava'a. And they are water people. And I say that people as because they are paddlers. And my children spend a lot of time in the water. And our ohana we have a house on the ocean. So they were raised in the water. So quite important to manage the resources, not only for the intake, but also to enjoy it, right? And so for us, it was just the connection and the connectivity to aina and the management of the resource and the lack of resource management. And for that reasoning, for me, it was really important to support the conservation of it or the revitalization of it or however you would like to look at that, but that there would be that resource available for future generations. And I felt that I knew that it wouldn't happen in my lifetime, that I hope that any changes that could be made could happen in my children's lifetime or their children's lifetime. So it was really important to me to see as much as they enjoyed it or we enjoyed it as a family, that it could still be enjoyed for future. And it wasn't only just the enjoyment of it. It's also that it is, as most Hawaii people will say, it's the icebox, right? We do partake from it. And in order to partake from it, we have to give the reciprocity of living, breathing thing, right? So there is that kuleana that is instilled in us as kanakas to take care of something that takes care of us, right? So that is the way we look at it. So very blessed to be able to do so.
Luna, it seems like a no-brainer to me. Like, I understand why from your perspective, from Dar's perspective, you want to get people like Miley together. You want a whole room of those people as like the decision makers. But talk a bit about the process aspect here of like how you scale this up to be able to gather these people and then get them to come to a consensus about how decisions should be made.
We started out with about like 80 to 90 names. We got it down to about like 30, and then we ended up with a team of 20. We have 16 that are still officially part of the team. So that's building the team. As far as building the plan, that was a whole different process because we started off virtual, having these virtual meetings, and trying to start building a team virtually is very hard, and they had mentioned that, and we were having some issues, and we finally did on our third meeting have that in person, and that was an opportunity for like some fishers to size each other up and be like, who are you? And it was really good to have an in person. It broke down a lot of like the barriers, and we were just able to have face to face, and I think that's what the team was wanting. And this was in July, a month before the fires happened. Right. So we had all come together for 2 days. We were jamming. We had shared like different ideas. We were moving, and then the fire happened. So we're just like, you know what? Even though we're jamming, like, you guys need to take a pause. Like, you guys need to take care of Maui. So we paused. Everybody's like, oh, what are you doing? We're like, well, we can write our lessons learned about like how things have gone so far and how building the team and all of that. Right. So we have our lessons learned. And then when January came, we're like, you know, it's been some time. We reached out to the folks in Lahaina. I was like, hey, and we talked to the team. They said, when you guys is ready, we're ready to roll. And they're like, yeah. So we started up again in February. And by September, we had a draft plan. So in 7 months, plus the couple months before that, before the fires happened, that's how long it took to create a draft where the team was comfortable to share out one time in Maui. So not only did they create it, they were the spokes for it. So they presented the plan and were the ones up answering the questions. They kind of just like was the content holder, which was night and day from how it started. Like when the government is out there, it's just like, oh, you guys making rules, you guys doing this. And it was night and day, because now it's like these folks were nominated, like we nominated them, and they're up there representing us. This is the plan that they created for us. And it was like, that's what we've been hoping for, right? And everybody's like, that was the whole of the process. And I would say like folks on the team joined, and they were joining because they're like, we don't want you guys shutting down fishing. Like we don't trust you guys. And now they're like, hey, we put it up on our website, on our YouTube, like you can put our name on top of it. And they're calling the fishing like, no, that's not how it was. And I think that's what Holomo was about, because DAR doesn't have to be the one pushing and driving. Like the community is theirs and they want to succeed. And so we kind of just stepped back and let them do what they wanted to do. And I think that's the difference, that people support this. And now when we're going to Hawaii Island, it's like, yeah, we want this over here because we see what the opportunities. And so now we're just having to like kind of refine what we did in Maui for a bigger island. Miley can talk about some of the meetings where they were, I mean, it's awesome. They call each other out. They're like, no, you can't say that. And they're like, well, this is what I do. This is my area. And it's okay. And that's what I loved about it, is like you bring people together with all these different ideas and perspectives. You find solutions that wouldn't have been thought of originally. So that's the beauty of this.
I love that point. Miley, is there any example that comes to mind of something like that, of a disagreement that the team might have had, and then how you found a solution and hopefully, you know, stayed respectful, right?
I don't know if I want to say we found the solution yet, but I will say this. The process as far as resolving or conflict resolution has been quite interesting for us. But as I had said to some people recently, it's about respect, right? It's about taking the time to not only respect those that are speaking and the what they bring to the table, but also their ike and the mana'o, right? And what it is behind that. And for us, it was really, the word came down to consensus, right? What can we live with? What can we live without? What are the really hard things that we just can't decide on? And I'll tell you what that is. That's opihi. Opihi still to this day is an item on the agenda every time we meet. Have we come to a resolution yet? No, we have not. But we pick it apart every single time in laughter, in frustration. But also at the end of the day, we do make gains. I need people to understand that and know that. So, you know, for us, it really was about breaking it down moku by moku and what resources were beneficial, what resources really needed, most help wanted type of thing. And just having those hard conversations with a lot of respect in the room. And, you know, in the beginning, it was feeling each other out. It was healing relationships with the state. And that's one of the biggest things to talk about. Sometimes it's not about the resource. It's about the relationships and the relationships to each other, not just to Aina. So for us, it's still, that was a struggle. And I think we got past that to know that we've made some leaps and bounds in the last so many years that others, I hope, make on the other islands. And, you know, you'll come to some resolution, but I may say that it is really about the respect and the relationship to people and place.
It's a great segue, because in May you are rolling this out on Hawaii Island, and as part of that, hosting these talk story sessions. Who are the kind of people that you want to show up to them?
Everyday people. I mean, people who are concerned about nearshore resources, who go to the beach, who eat fish, who enjoy just spending time with their kids at the beach. Like, it's for Hawaii Island residents. Like, we're really looking to build like a nearshore management plan. And maybe they don't fish, but maybe they do stuff up Mauka, and so they can come and like, hey, like if we take care of Mauka, like we've been seeing this at Mauka, like it'll help you guys on the Makai side, right? So, I mean, we're trying to get everybody to get included.
And Miley, one last question for you. What would your pitch be to a community member, someone on Hawaii Island who cares a lot about where they live, about why they should consider being part of this project as it moves over to their island?
Good question. I think a lot of times people don't realize that they're stakeholders and they don't understand what a stakeholdership means. And the thing is, it's a see something, say something, right? So if you do see something that you're concerned with, you want to say something. This is the opportunity. And I will say this time and time again, we are very blessed and fortunate to the funders of this project because it is the first time the state has done a bottom-up approach. So take the time to take this opportunity to invest in the future of our Aina. Because if we don't, then this possibility and this process may be taken away. What we really would like to see is this works so well on all the islands that the state looks at their processes and says, no, we no longer are going to go top down. We're going to always go bottom up because we feel that it's the best way to do it. The resources that people speak to the resource, they are the resource. They are part of the Aina. I'm a true believer, and Luna knows this, that if you don't say anything, then you have nothing to say. If you choose to come back later on and give your 2 cents, then it's quite unfortunate because you had that opportunity. Don't come after the fact. Come from the beginning. Be part of the process. Be open. Be committed. And at the end of the day, it's really the resource is what we're looking at. And that is, it is not finite resource, is it? Right? You know, you talk about that and people think, oh yeah, you know, no, it isn't. It is not. And we have to care for it as it cares for us. So for those that are considering the process, at least come once, listen to it, resonate with it. As we say, as Kanakas, just kind of like it miko, let it sit for and marinate for a little bit, right? Or sit in the muliwai, which is the fresh and salt water, that you're able to just kind of let it speak to you and see what it's going to say. And should I be involved in this process? Do I really have a stakeholdership in it? And what can I do to make our resource better? Yeah, just be part of the process and don't be upset that you weren't when you had the chance. Yeah.
That was Miley Shannon and Luna Kikoa of the Holomua Marine Initiative. They were talking to HPR's Maddie Bender. Holomua launches this month on the island of Hawaii with a series of 7 talk story sessions. The first will be held tomorrow, May 5th, at the Kohala Intergenerational Center. Head to our website for more information. That is it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to get an update on the recovery from the super typhoon in the Northern Marianas that killed 17 people. Got feedback for us? Caller talkback line 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple, or just check our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.